6 Republican governors are sending more National Guard troops to Washington, D.C. Many have cities with higher crime rates than the Capitol. We'll ask a former top official of the National Guard Bureau what he thinks. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Texas Republicans are expected to approve a redistricting plan this week. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Amy Martinez. We'll hear from one Democrat who refused to leave the state house protesting state trooper escorts after Democrats broke quorum. Also, visit to a Hollywood clubhouse that helps members with serious mental illness find community. It's Wednesday, August 20th. On this day in 1945, Brooklyn Dodger Tommy Brown hit his first Major League home run. He was only 17, still the record for the youngest player to hit a homer. Didn't help the Dodgers win, though. They lost 11-1 to the Pirates. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Texas State House is set to hold a preliminary vote as early as today on a new congressional map. The House plan is a little different than the map being considered by the Texas State Senate, but both aim to create new districts that could send 5 more Republicans to the U.S. House in next year's midterm elections. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider reports.
A Texas House committee rushed through its alternative map as one of the first orders of business after Democrats returned on Monday and the chamber reestablished a quorum. The main difference between the House and Senate map is in the Houston area, where the House's proposed 9th congressional district would expand to include the largely rural and conservative Liberty County. That would all but guarantee that the district, which has long been represented by Congressman Al Green, would shift from Democratic to Republican. For NPR News, I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Separately, Democratic state lawmakers in California have introduced measures to start redistricting in their state. They say it's in response to what Texas state Republicans are doing. The California lawmakers say they want to try to add 5 Democrats to the U.S. House to negate any gains that Texas Republicans might get. California lawmakers are supposed to vote on their proposal tomorrow. Forecasters say Hurricane Erin is swirling in the Atlantic Ocean between the North Carolina coast and Bermuda. Its top sustained winds are at 100 miles per hour. Erin will not make landfall in the U.S., but it is triggering dangerous rip currents along the shore. Michael Brennan is the director of the National Hurricane Center. He says people need to stay out of the water from Florida up to New England.
It's not going to be safe to get into the ocean. High to moderate risk of rip currents everywhere along the U.S. East Coast, pretty much. So stay out of those ocean waters if they appear dangerous, if those warning flags are flying.
Even though the storm won't strike land, authorities in North Carolina have ordered some evacuations on barrier islands. Forecasters say weather conditions are expected to deteriorate along the North Carolina coast by tonight. Air Canada flights are returning to service. They had been grounded after 10,000 flight attendants went on strike. Dan Karpinchuk reports that both sides reached a tentative contract agreement yesterday.
Details of the agreement won't be announced until flight attendants have a chance to vote on it, but both sides say the issue of pay for unpaid work hours has been resolved. The other key issue is wages. The Union for the Flight Attendants, the Canadian Union of Public Employees, called the tentative deal a win. Thousands of travelers are still scrambling to make alternate arrangements. Air Canada's Chief Operating Officer, Mark Nasser, says the airline is working round the clock to rebook customers on Air Canada as well as 120 other airlines, including competitors. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
You're listening to NPR News. Israel says it's calling up another 50,000 reservists. They'll be used in a major military operation against Hamas in Gaza City. The increase would nearly double the number of active Israeli reservists in the war in Gaza. North Korea has forcefully rejected efforts by South Korea's new president to lower tension and resume dialogue. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Seoul. The snub comes days before a U.S.-South Korean summit in Washington.
Since taking office in June, President Lee Jae-myung has promised to respect the North's political system, removed loudspeakers blaring propaganda into the North, and promised to restore a 2018 military tension-reducing agreement. But leader Kim Jong-un's sister, Kim Yo-jong, said Lee is not the sort of man who will change history. And South Korea cannot become a diplomatic partner of the North. She added that the South knows perfectly well that there's no going back to the days of friendlier relations. Kim Yo-jong has acknowledged personal ties between her brother and President Trump, leaving open the possibility of future talks with the U.S. if it drops what Pyongyang considers its hostile attitude. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
Walmart is recalling frozen raw shrimp sold in 13 states. That's because federal health officials are concerned about potential radioactive contamination. The health officials say they found a radioactive isotope in some shrimp imported from a single supplier in Indonesia. Those toxic shrimp never got to the U.S. market, but officials don't want anyone eating any shrimp from that supplier. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. This is NPR.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
In 1905, William Williams was convicted of murdering a St. Paul teen and his mother. In 1906, he was sentenced to die by hanging. This was Minnesota's last execution because a botched hanging made public by aggressive news reporting shifted public opinion. At the time, the press was banned from covering executions due to the John Day Smith Law, frequently called the Midnight Assassination Law. It required private nighttime execution of prisoners in order to banish crowds. Reporter Joseph Hennessy, writing for the St. Paul Daily News, snuck in and witnessed the gruesome hanging and wrote about William's agonizing death.
The sheriff had miscalculated the length of the rope, and so William Williams fell through the scaffold trap. His feet hit the floor, and it took about 14 minutes for him to die by strangulation.
That's historian Michael Anderson, detailing what should have been an instant death. Despite this ban on reporting, the St. Paul Pioneer Press, the St. Paul Dispatch, and the St. Paul Daily News carried the story with the gory details. The newspapers were fined $25 each, but the accounts were enough to cause public outcry over capital punishment. And in 1911, lawmakers outlawed the practice.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. A total of six states have now promised to send their National Guard troops to Washington, D.C.
That will add more than 1,100 new soldiers to patrol the streets. The deployments follow President Trump's declaring what he called a, quote, crime emergency in the Capitol, unquote. All the states sending troops are led by Republicans, and that has some others expressing concern that the Guard is being politicized. In a few minutes, we'll speak to a former Vice Chief of the National Guard Bureau to get his take on whether this use of the Guard matches its expertise. But first,
NPR criminal justice reporter Meg Anderson joins us to explain. So as Michelle just mentioned, the deployments are from states with Republican governors. I mean, that can't be a coincidence, is it?
Yeah, it's not. So far, the states are West Virginia, South Carolina, Mississippi, Louisiana, Ohio, and as of yesterday, Tennessee. And, you know, in their statements, they echoed what Trump has said about crime in D.C. South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster said the troops were there to, quote, support President Trump and his mission to restore law and order. And this really is falling mostly on partisan lines. Yesterday, Governor Laura Kelly of Kansas, she's the chair of the Democratic Governors Association, put out a statement urging state leaders to, quote, reject the temptation to use their soldiers to reinforce a dangerous, politically motivated agenda. And I should note, Vermont Governor Phil Scott, he's a Republican. He said he's not going to send his troops. He didn't feel like it would be an acceptable and appropriate use of them.
Okay, now, the thing I think a lot of people find puzzling is that many of these states are sending troops to D.C., have cities with crime rates that are higher than the Capitol. Don't they need them?
Yeah, that's true. I looked at last year's murder rates, and in Jackson, Mississippi, the murder rate was more than four times the rate in D.C. In Memphis, it was nearly triple. In New Orleans, it was nearly double. I spoke about this with Incha Raman. She's with the advocacy group, the Vera Institute of Justice. They work to end mass incarceration.
Trump enlisting Republican governors to send National Guard troops signals one thing very clearly, that this is about a political power grab and political theater, not about making cities safer.
To be clear, D.C. still has had higher violent crime rates than many other major cities, but the numbers are falling.
Now, did you reach out to any of those governors who are deploying troops?
I did. I only heard back from Ohio Governor Mike DeWine's office. They said they've sent their troops outside the state before, including the inaugurations of both President Trump and former President Joe Biden, and also to protests in Minneapolis and natural disasters in Florida, North Carolina, and Louisiana.
So how well-suited is the National Guard at actually policing streets?
So the National Guard usually is engaged in crowd control or helping in the aftermath of a natural disaster. They are not experienced in doing local police work. Policing expert Mark Krupansky noted that, too. He's with Arnold Ventures, a group that funds criminal justice initiatives, and he says he suspects using the Guard like this is not going to reduce crime.
This is kind of described as like the grenade effect, where they throw a considerable amount of resources at a problem over a short period of time. And that might help to drive that number down in the short term, but it doesn't actually help address the problem over the long run.
And, you know, he stressed that there are long-term strategies that we do know work in lowering crime, things like community policing and boosting social services in neighborhoods, like adding employment opportunities and mental health resources.
That is NPR's Meg Anderson. Meg, thanks.
You're welcome.
Let's hear more about this from a former top official in the National Guard, retired Major General Randy Manner. He served as Vice Chief of the National Guard Bureau. He was part of the D.C. National Guard between 1997 and 2012. And I also want to mention he's had a long career in both the National Guard and on active duty. So welcome, retired Major General. Thanks so much for joining us. And thank you also for your honorable service.
Well, you're very welcome, and thank you as well.
So we asked D.C.'s Joint Task Force last night about the Guard's mission, and they told us they support law enforcement in, quote, maintaining order and ensuring that public spaces are safe and well-maintained, unquote. So we've seen National Guard troops brought in times of civil unrest. We've all seen that. We've also seen them support major events like an inauguration. But have you seen anything like this in the past?
This is unprecedented. It would not meet the criteria for the deployment of National Guardsmen whatsoever. This is absolutely a law enforcement operation in the very best of cases. It is not a military operation. It does not require National Guardsmen or active duty military. And no matter what anyone says, this does not meet the criteria. I've never seen anything like this in my 36 years of service.
What concerns you most about how the National Guard troops will be utilized in D.C.? I guess, what informs your view of this?
Some of the other speakers talked about the fact that our National Guard is not trained in policing actions. This is not what they do. They are predominantly in support operations. And so that's the first and most important thing. They don't have the experience and the training that the Metropolitan Police and other law enforcement agencies have. The second one is that it actually negatively impacts military readiness because it pulls people, soldiers and airmen, out of their units and reduces their ability for those units to prepare for war, for deployment. Hmm. It also, quite frankly, the sad thing is this is a political prop. Our young soldiers and airmen are political props, and it's something where they are actually... It's being done on the backs of our young men and women. We think about it. Many of these young soldiers and airmen actually earn more money in their civilian jobs than they do in the military. So you're having people deployed. Some people are being pulled out of vacations. Some people are being pulled out of college. And here they are moving in for no legitimate reason.
So let's break up. Let's take some of these issues sort of one by one. I mean, you were part of a group, the Bipartisan National Security Leaders for America, that issued a statement saying that the National Guard is stretched nearly to its breaking point. What do you mean by that? I particularly want to hear about your concerns about readiness.
The most important thing that we are here to do is, number one, to be able to serve as the strategic reserve for the United States for our active duty military forces for overseas deployments. The National Guard is involved every single day around the world performing missions that are critical to the well-being in the United States. And the number two mission is to support the states in terms of natural disasters such as we're coming up in hurricane season, or forest fires or flooding. We are there to help the American people. This is actually also changing the entire context of the way that the average citizens in these cities are going to start viewing both our National Guardsmen and our military. If you remember back to 9/11, after that period, we had National Guardsmen in every airport. The objective was to reassure the people that it is safe to fly. And in fact, it actually did that for the many months that they were serving there. This, in contrast, is where we should not have military on our streets in our American cities. It is absolutely the way that dictatorships run, not democracies.
It's interesting. It seems to be that you're saying in part that it's a readiness issue, it's a training issue, it's a suitability issue, but you're also concerned that people will stop looking at the Guard as people there to help them, but
That's
see
correct.
Them as people who are there to do something to them or to occupy them or as an occupying force, that they might
exactly.
be a target in a way, is I think
exactly
what you're saying.
That's correct. Military vehicles in front of public buildings and the idea of constantly there with weapons, that is absolutely called intimidation. And I'm very concerned about the impact on both our recruiting as well as, of course, the perception of many of the people of color as they see the National Guardsmen from other states coming in to occupy Washington, D.C.
And before we let you go, as briefly as you can, when we asked the Joint Task Force about rules of engagement, they said that all service members deployed will get an initial briefing on the mission and operational environment, and that prepares them. Is that enough?
No, absolutely not. They are called rules for the use of force, and the last one that I actually saw was for 2020 for the D.C. National Guard. Every soldier is supposed to have a plastic card in their pocket that explains exactly what they're supposed to do, and it is drilled into them. It's not supposed to be a one-time briefing. This is a very dangerous, potentially dangerous situation. Again, it's a police action, not a military action.
That is retired Major General Randy Manner, who served as Vice Chief of the National Guard Bureau. He's now with the bipartisan group National Security Leaders for America. Major General, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And I also want to mention that we asked the Republican governors of states sending National Guard deployments to the nation's capital to join us for an interview. They were not available or didn't respond to our invitation.
Hurricane Erin is churning along the Atlantic coast of the United States. It's a Category 2 storm. It's not expected to make landfall, but the storm is bringing high waves, winds, and rip currents to parts of the shore. Now, the biggest impact will likely be in North Carolina's Outer Banks, where people have evacuated because of flooding risks. From member station WUNC, here's Charisse Piggott.
Two counties along the North Carolina coast have been under mandatory evacuation since Monday. Bob Woodard is the commission chair of one of the coastal counties. He says tens of thousands of tourists have heeded the evacuation order as of yesterday.
A good majority of the visitors have left, and we feel confident that a lot of the residents have left, and we're seeing very little traffic on NC-12 right now.
NC Highway 12 is the only road to Hatteras Island, and there's fear that it could become impassable because of flooding. According to the National Weather Service, the region is expected to get tropical storm winds and up to 20-foot waves that could wash into the island through Thursday. Eric Hayden is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service. He says no matter the strength of Hurricane Erin as it moves parallel to the East Coast, the impact on North Carolina will not change.
It's really the immediate coastline, severe beach erosion, large waves, places like Ocracoke Island, Hatteras Island. That by far is where we're most concerned.
Governor Josh Stein declared a state of emergency on Tuesday ahead of Erin's arrival. The state has opened shelters further inland and provided transportation for those who needed to get to them. Hotels have seen an impact. Jamie Chisholm is the president of the Outer Banks Local Motel and Hotel Association.
So we are seeing cancellations.
But she says some people are sheltering in hotels.
We are also seeing bookings from evacuees who are hoping that the storm passes by quickly and perhaps they can get back to their vacation homes that they have booked in the evacuation areas.
Beaches even outside the evacuation zone are closed and no swimming advisories are in place up and down the East Coast at a time when the tourism season is still going strong. For NPR News, I'm Charisse Piggott.
This is NPR News.
listeners know how important it is to support stations like KAXE KBXE.
Anyone who can, be sure to donate, because as all of us know, we listen to this green cheese and all the other programming on the stations. We really, really love it and don't want anything to happen to it. So it's really important to give what you can.
One thing I wanted to do is I wanted to talk to everybody out there. Radio is important when it's unique and it's interesting and it's local. And given your current funding situation, everybody out there should be doing something about that, no matter how little it is. If everybody did something, it makes a tremendous difference. Think about Saturday nights with no green cheese. That sounds terrible.
Awful. It would be so boring.
This is the queen, and I'm going to make an edict. All cheeses, get your checkbooks out and send in some money to our favorite station and show, and my check will be in the mail tomorrow.
Donate now at KAXE.org.
And from the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Americans United for Separation of Church and State, since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. An exclusive new clubhouse is flourishing in Hollywood. Like all clubhouses, it offers members a place to hang out. But this club is unique. To join, a member must have a serious mental illness. Renee Montaigne has the story about Fountain House Hollywood. And here is where I want to let you know that this piece contains a reference to suicide.
When I first visited the clubhouse, what struck me the most was the hum of activity.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
All right, here you go.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, are we ready, folks?
Yes, let's do it.
All right. Welcome to the Fountain House Hollywood meeting. Who will be the conversation wrangler? Meetings are important at Fountain House Hollywood because the members run the clubhouse. That means signing up for an array of jobs, cooking meals, shopping, organizing field trips. It's what Fountain House calls a work-ordered day, and it brings structure, support, and companionship, something that severe mental illness has stolen from them.
It's three words. Community is therapy, and it works.
Jill Santanero is the clubhouse director. She's one of a tiny support staff, just three altogether. They mingle comfortably with the more than 100 members who can come any day of the week. This clubhouse model of community-based mental health care was, in fact, started 75 years ago by a group of former patients in Manhattan. Over the years, hundreds of such clubhouses have spread worldwide. This morning, Fountain House Hollywood member Gennaro Simeone is giving me the tour.
We have our newsletter here, Fountain House Times here, that we print up from this area here. And this gentleman over here, Mark Logan, has made a book. He's written a book about his personal life.
It's called Hard Pill to Swallow, My Manic Memoir.
Mark Logan has a vivid memory of the day his bipolar disorder emerged with a bang.
Yeah, back in 1991, I stopped drinking alcohol and 6 weeks later found myself getting arrested in a bank wearing a black leather jockstrap and a pink Easter bonnet.
Logan spent the next 5 weeks in a psych ward being treated for psychosis. His self-published memoir is a head-spinning tale of chaos. Chronic homelessness, drugs, dozens of arrests, even another attempted bank robbery, also in drag, this time landing Logan in prison. In the end, he destroyed virtually every relationship. My diagnosis, he writes, became a curse for the rest of my life.
I'm Dr. Lisa Wong, and I am the director of mental health for the County of Los Angeles.
Her department services a quarter of a million residents, including more than 15,000 homeless who report that they are living with severe mental illness. Wong spent more than 20 years providing care on LA's Skid Row. Over and over, she says, the clinicians would observe that those outpatients who scored high for debilitating illnesses like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder did improve, yes, when provided with medication and shelter.
Which was great. That's what we were hoping for. But 6 months down the road, upon retesting, you see a different score spike, and that would be depression. Because now we're dealing with somebody who may have an amelioration of their psychotic symptoms, but is finding themselves not connected, no meaningful activity, even if they have a roof over their head and food to eat.
So when Lisa Wong was named head of the Department of Mental Health 2 years ago, her first thought was to bring a fountain house to Hollywood.
It doesn't, though, take the place of outpatient services like medication and therapy and case management and those kinds of things. But I think the clubhouse model is so essential in taking people to the next step, to where they actually are entering into recovery and not just surviving.
They want you to be a success. They want you to be independent.
Georgette Darby was among a handful of original members who advised Fountain House in New York on its new Hollywood clubhouse. In her 50s, Darby lost her job as a legal secretary. Then a few years of couch surfing exhausted even her closest friends. Until finally,
I became homeless, so I would be downtown, walking the streets downtown with my suitcase, or either catch the bus and ride the bus all night. So I said to myself, I can't do this no more. I can't. I just wanted to die.
Georgette Darby walked in front of an oncoming bus. That attempted suicide opened the door for a diagnosis and treatment of her major depressive disorder, plus the supportive housing she was desperate for. Yet it wasn't until she became part of the clubhouse that she started to flourish.
Before Fountain House, I really wouldn't go out. I would just be at home. I look forward to coming here every day because it gives me a sense of purpose.
Carrington Wallace is another member who has found a purpose at the clubhouse. His childhood was spent mostly in foster care. Then a few years ago in his mid-20s, the voices began.
That's the schizophrenia. That's schizoaffective disorder.
Wallace knows the voices he hears aren't real, but even his meds can't completely silence them.
I can't sleep at night sometimes because the air conditioner that I have on won't shut up. It'll keep talking and talking and talking and talking and talking and talking, and I can't cut it off.
At Fountain House, he's managed to overcome the noise within him to take on a job helping other members by answering calls.
It's a clubhouse model to have an open channel for a member to call in and talk about their problems or talk about what they're going through and whatever they want to talk about.
Mark Logan also has a part-time job, and he's learned how to cultivate the kind of supportive relationships that are key to maintaining mental health.
There is one person that I met here at the clubhouse, and we're very good friends now. And we both have the same diagnosis. We understand each other, and we know the warning signs before a full-blown manic episode or a psychotic episode.
For all of its members, there is one more feature of the clubhouse model that is key. Once you're a member, you're always a member. Carrington Wallace says he'll never leave.
I love the fact that I'm here. I like the fact that I'm surrounded by peers. A lot of us have suffered from abuse. A lot of us have suffered from not having the community that we need. So I think that the fact we have our community now is why it's so precious.
Fountain House Hollywood aims to triple its membership in the next 2 years, and it won't be alone. The LA County Mental Health Department is investing Medicaid dollars into transforming 6 peer resource centers into full-fledged clubhouses. They will be run by and for their members in the classic clubhouse model. For NPR News, I'm Renee Montaigne in Los Angeles.
This is NPR News.
One of Europe's largest mass graves is being unearthed in Ireland. The victims are children who died in a home for unwed mothers.
It's blatantly obvious. They had no regard for those children because they're illegitimate.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. How the Grave tells the story of the Catholic Church in Ireland on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can hear All Things Considered later today at 4 o'clock with your local host, Jennifer Barr. My name is Andrew DeZingle, and you are listening to KAXE, KBXE, People Power Radio. Grand Rapids Urfest is Saturday, September 6th. This year's lineup, Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Tickets and info at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. Want to volunteer at the event? head to GrandRapidsUrfest.com under Get Involved. Central Lakes College in Brainerd invites musicians to audition for one of its 9 ensembles this academic year, open to students and community members of any age. These ensembles offer opportunities in a variety of styles. Auditions are August 21st and 22nd, as well as August 25th. Call or text KAXE for more information at 218-326-1234. Ripple River Gallery, south of Deerwood, hosts the dual exhibit Reclaimed/Reframed, now through September 28th, featuring sculptures from KAXE's own John Bauer, paired with photographs from Rachel Kane. The exhibit proves that one person's trash is another person's treasure. Open Wednesday through Saturday from 10 to 5 and Sundays 11 to 4. Tickets are now on sale for Hadestown, August 21st through the 25th at the Mask and Rose Women's Theater in Popaski. The musical follows intertwined love stories from Greek mythology in a stylized underworld. Tickets are only available in advance at McKenzie Place in Bemidji. The 19th annual White Oak Antique Tractor Show is August 23rd and 24th, 1 mile north of Deer River on Highway 6. Each day will feature a pancake breakfast and parade, as well as demos throughout the day. Raffle for a 1947 Farm Isle tractor and a farmer's market. Free and open to all. Now it's time for your Daily Dose of Phenology, where John Latimer takes a look back at his nature notes from this date.
On today's date, August 20th, 1989, I noticed my first flock of common grackles, a large flock of birds, and noisy and raucous and oftentimes not well received because they sweep into a yard and they congregate in these big flocks and they make a lot of racket and people tend to think ill of them. But grackles are actually a pretty interesting bird. They're seen in the close-up. They're a lovely sort of an iridescent blue-green on the head and shoulders and then fading into a black body, a large gold eye and a long dark beak. The bird also has an amazing habit of being very, very generous and kind with any young of the flock. In other words, it doesn't seek out its own young when it finds some treasure to feed. It just turns and feeds the first young bird nearby. And you can't say too much ill about a bird who's that generous with his food sources. They do flock up and they do make a racket, but they also take care of one another, and that's to be commended.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And me, Martinez.
Texas Republicans are on the verge of redrawing the state's congressional districts for President Trump.
Trump wants the change to help Republicans win potentially five more seats in next year's elections. Now, other states are looking to support or counter that. Texas Democrats left the state for a couple of weeks to try to slow it down.
The Texas Newsroom's Blaze Gainey is in Austin to discuss this. So, Blaze, Texas Democrats came back to the legislature Monday after their walkout. So where do things stand now?
Yeah, so first, while they were gone, House Democrats were threatened with arrest or being replaced. And when they came back to the House floor, Republican House Speaker Dustin Burroughs ordered them to sign a paper if they wanted to leave, pledging they'd show up for today's session. And until then, they'll be technically under custody of Texas law enforcement. Most of them signed and went home, except for one who refused, Representative Nicole Collier. She calls it demeaning, and she's so far refused to sign and has chosen to stay in the chamber since Monday, giving interviews and even slept there. It's become a form of protest, and some Democratic colleagues tore their papers up and said they were joining her last night, and she was planning on staying there again.
Wow. Okay, so remind us again what the issue is at stake here. What are Texas Republicans trying to do?
Yeah, I mean, Texas Republicans want more seats in Congress. Right now, there are 38 congressional districts in Texas. 25 are held by Republicans. And Republicans are trying to redraw the districts based on how people have voted in the past to give their party an edge in at least five more seats. Republicans say this is legal. They note that Democrats have done it in other states in the past, but usually states do redistricting at the start of the decade when the national census count comes in. Democrats say these maps that Republicans have drawn weakens the vote of Black and Latino voters in ways that are illegal, and they will challenge in court. Republican lawmakers aim to vote in favor of this plan today and then in Senate tomorrow. And Governor Greg Abbott, a Trump ally, is expected to sign it when it gets to him.
So other states are watching Texas, especially the one state with a bigger population, Democratic-led California. So what might California do?
Yes, that's correct. And, you know, this is all prompted by the movement from President Trump in Texas. Several other states are talking about mid-decade redistricting right now. The main one, as you said, California, they are directly to counter Texas. Democrats in the California legislature have actually drawn a map that'll give an edge to five more Democrats next year. They plan to vote on that this week. But they are seeking approval of voters in a special election in November because, unlike Texas, California law requires that an independent commission do the redistricting to take the politics out of it. Now they want voters to approve redistricting without that commission. The legislature might vote on that Thursday, but California Republicans have filed a lawsuit yesterday trying to slow that down. Now, some other Republicans in Democratic states are talking about redistricting too, but for right now, Republicans only hold the House by a few seats, so a five-seat swing either way could really make a difference for President Trump's agenda.
All right, that's Blaze Gainey of the Texas Newsroom. Blaze, thank you very much for this update.
Thank you.
So Blaze just told us about Texas Democratic State Representative Nicole Collier, who spent two nights in the Texas House chamber after refusing to leave in the custody of law enforcement. On Tuesday, she spoke with our co-host Leila Fadel.
I want to start with that permission slip. The Speaker of the House, Dustin Burroughs, a Republican, told you and your colleagues you could leave only if you signed this permission slip and walked out with law enforcement following you, escorting you. And you refused. Why did you refuse?
Well, I'm not a criminal. I've not done anything wrong. I've exercised my constitutional right to deny quorum. And what they have asked is for members to agree to be released into the custody of DPS. It's not just an escort. It's in the custody as if we have committed some type of crime to fulfill their political theater. So I'm not going to go along with that. I disagree. I oppose strongly. It just didn't sit well with me. And I'm fed up. I'm refusing to do exactly what they want.
You were locked in the chamber when you refused. Were you expecting that?
Oh, I'm still locked in the chamber. I'm not surprised, but I'm disappointed because you don't have to do these things. The quorum has been restored. I came here voluntarily. I have the right to use my voice and my speech of resistance.
You've said a few times since this happened and is happening, as you said, you're still in the chamber, that this is authoritarian. Tell me why.
Well, I mean, it just is an example of the lengths that Republicans will go to get what they want, locking members in the chamber who don't comply. You know, this is not what a free democracy does. You have a right to challenge government. And when you start silencing the voices of those people who disagree, then we are moving further away. And we've got to put a stop to it. We've got to take a stand and protect the freedoms that we have, because, you know, before we know it, we won't have any freedoms to defend.
You posted a photo of yourself reclined at your desk in a bonnet and an eye mask. How'd you sleep?
I slept. I was able to get some sleep on the floor in my chair. The lights do not cut off in this building, in this place. So it was very bright. But you know, with all this DPS here, I kind of felt safe.
There will be a vote.
Yeah.
What happens then?
You know, it's very disappointing that Republicans have showed their hand. And maybe they did it on purpose. They have shown us that they want to do Trump's bidding first. They don't want to put the flood victims and the people first. They want to do what Trump has instructed them to do. So it's very disappointing. We are ready to have a fight on the floor in terms of contesting these maps and exposing the harmful impacts that they will have on communities of color. Once we finish this floor fight, we'll take it to the courts.
Now, California Governor Gavin Newsom is pushing for his own partisan redistricting plan, saying if Texas is going to do it, then we're going to have to do it too. You fled the state to stop this type of redistricting. Does this now start a catastrophic fight between the two parties that could hurt the democratic process?
Listen, you know what? There was a time where you would take the high road, but that high road has crumbled. We're on the dirt road, and we're going to meet them in the dirt. This is like Governor Newsom said, we're going to fight fire with fire. We've got to be ready to respond accordingly. We'll rebuild that high road, but right now we're in the dirt, and we've got to roll up our sleeves and get dirty.
That was Democratic State Representative Nicole Collier speaking with Leila Fadel yesterday from the Texas House floor. This afternoon on All Things Considered, a new study finds that fish may experience pleasure from being cleaned by other fish, something like the experience of getting a massage. And some fish work harder than others to experience that pleasure again. Listen on a smart speaker in the NPR app or on this public radio station. This is NPR News.
You are listening to Morning Edition here on KAXE, KBXE, People Power Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. After Dark is KAXE Saturday night program after Green Cheese from 9 to midnight, featuring styles of music like punk, metal, EDM, R&B, hip-hop, and more. This week's host, Brian Millen, will be playing ambient electronica. Interested in hosting? Email dgannon at kaxe.org. Walker Bay Theater presents On Golden Pond, August 20th through the 24th. Shows are at 3 p.m. on Wednesday and Sunday, and Friday and Saturday shows are at 7 p.m. Located in downtown Walker on Minnesota Avenue. Tickets available at the door. Northland Arboretum in Brainerd offers guided hikes the third Thursday of each month at 9:30 a.m., hikes are 1 hour long, and dogs are welcome on a leash. The Virginia Public Library is holding a used book sale August 20th through the 23rd at Iron Trail Motors Event Center. Hours are from noon to 7 Wednesday through Friday and from 9 to 1 on Saturday. United Way of Bemidji hosts a wine and beer tasting social Thursday, August 21st from 4:30 to 7:30 at the Sanford Center. You must be 21 years or older to attend. The event includes live music, a silent auction, and raffle. Tickets available at unitedwaybemidji.org. Now back to Morning Edition.
Join us Saturday, September 6th for Grand Rapids River Fest. I'm Jennifer Barr, and I am so excited for this year's lineup. Music starts at 3 o'clock with Alan Sparhawk, a prolific and versatile musician best known as the frontman of Low. His many side projects over the years reveal a musician unafraid to experiment. Then we'll hear Jeremy Albino. His songs are grounded in the gritty storytelling of classic country music propelled by the rhythms of old school R&B. And then Margot Price. She has something to say but nothing to prove, and in just a few solo albums she has cemented herself as a force in Americana music. We'll end our night with Courtney Barnett, one of Australia's most successful musical exports. She has played many festivals around the world, including Coachella, Bonnaroo, Lollapalooza, and now Grand Rapids River Fest. Find tickets and more info at grandrapidsriverfest.com. See you September 6th.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from AG1, maker of a drinkable multivitamin now available in three new flavors, tropical, berry, and citrus. Learn more at drinkag1.com. From Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at viking.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. For the first time in 30 years, the American Academy of Pediatrics is sharing vaccine recommendations that differ from the federal government's guidance. The pediatric group strongly recommends COVID-19 shots for children between the ages of 6 months and 2 years old. Now, the CDC is less explicit. It recommends the COVID vaccine for kids from 6 months to 17 years, quote, based on shared clinical decision making. Dr. Celine Gounder is an infectious disease specialist and editor-at-large for public health at KFF Health News, which frequently partners with NPR. Doctor, so the span of ages is obviously different in the two recommendations, but what sets those two apart the most?
Well, I think it's the strength of the recommendation that children, or really infants, between the ages of 6 months and 2 years get a COVID vaccine. The CDC advice is basically that, well, you know, healthy kids, do they really need this? So talk to your doctor if there's a particular reason you're concerned. But what we've seen in the data is that while the risk of death may be lower in these infants than, say, the elderly, they have a very high risk of ending up in the ER or in the hospital, in the ICU. And that's not an insignificant risk. I think most parents would opt for one shot versus having their child end up in the ICU. So this is really a recommendation that between the ages of 6 months and 2 years, while children have less developed immune systems, when you don't yet know if they have pre-existing conditions like immunocompromising conditions, and when they have smaller airways and are at higher risk for complications, during that period, those infants, their first interaction with COVID should be with the vaccine and not the virus.
So I'm guessing that you think that parents and other caregivers should have a lot of confidence in this recommendation from this professional body, and also confidence in the vaccine.
Well, and it's not just the American Academy for Pediatrics. So as part of this whole process, there's a group called the Vaccine Integrity Project out of the University of Minnesota that brought together all of the different medical professional societies, as well as vaccine experts, to do a comprehensive review of all of the new data that has come out since the CDC last did that review about a year ago. And that included some 16,000 studies that they looked at. They narrowed it down based on the quality of the study and focused their analyses. But they really crashed that analysis over the last couple months in order to inform the professional society's recommendation. So this is not just American Academy for Pediatrics. It's this independent group, which, by the way, has not taken pharmaceutical company money. I think that's really important to say here, that reviewed the data rigorously. And so the American Academy for Pediatrics is not just going out on its own. It has very solid ground to stand on in making these recommendations.
Doctor, do you think we're at a point in our history that when it comes to things like COVID and vaccines, that it all depends on who is in the White House that'll determine how the government feels about these kinds of recommendations?
I think that's exactly right. Unfortunately, this is an issue that has been highly politicized. And we've never seen anything like this before under a Republican or Democratic administration, that vaccine recommendations have become political and not scientific.
Dr. Celine Gounder is an infectious disease specialist and editor-at-large for public health at KFF Health News, which frequently partners with NPR. Doctor, thank you. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Chelsea Perkins with the KAXE Newsroom. We're still reporting, but our future just became uncertain. Congress voted to strip critical funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. That means $228,000 cut from KAXE and a major hit to rural journalism. These aren't just numbers. They're the resources we use to bring you the facts, to hold power accountable, and to tell your stories. Help keep the news alive in northern Minnesota. Go to KAXE.org or text DONATE to 218-326-1234. KAXE is powered by the people, including you.
I'm not crying, but I wish I could. Heart snapped off like plywood. How will I sand these scales from my skin?
More details are coming in about the Trump administration's plans to purchase a portion of the struggling chipmaker Intel.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Bitwarden Password Manager, designed to offer secure password management at this summer's events and festivals from any seat, section, or sideline. Available at bitwarden.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick has confirmed that the Trump administration is looking at the purchase of part of a big American corporation. The U.S. stake in Intel would be unusual but not unprecedented, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer explains.
Intel was already getting a federal grant under the Chips and Science Act, which was approved during the Biden administration. Yesterday, Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick told CNBC the U.S. should get something for that money.
Why are we giving a company worth $100 billion this kind of money? What is in it for the American taxpayer? And the answer Donald Trump has is we should get an equity stake for our money.
Lutnick says this would be a non-voting stake, so the Trump administration wouldn't have a say in how Intel was run. The U.S. government has done this before. It spent about $50 billion to bail out General Motors in 2008 during the Great Recession. But these types of deals can be risky for taxpayers. The government lost about $11 billion on its GM investment. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
More now on how the global artificial intelligence arms race could disrupt the job market. Today, a dispatch from the annual World AI Conference in Shanghai. China's government is pushing businesses to integrate the powerful tech across industries there. The tech can be a tool to make people more productive, but it can also be a tool for businesses to use fewer workers. Marketplace's China correspondent Jennifer Pack attended that conference in Shanghai.
Walking past is visitor Mao Zihang.
I've not seen anything impressive at this AI show.
And he's also not worried about being replaced by AI.
I'm in food delivery, and autonomous cars aren't even allowed in most places in China. How can they replace us delivery guys? Not likely in the short term.
But no jobs last forever, says Cheng Sirei. He's the co-founder of Fingerdance, an AI sign languages interpreter.
Yes, AI will reduce the number of jobs like in customer service. But I think AI can solve 80% of the trivial work, and we as humans can focus on the key jobs.
Like software engineering. And there will be new jobs for humans, says Mao Shuhan, co-founder of robotics firm FiBot.
For example, in our research and development of robots, we need humans to do robot testing and safety checks.
Later, a young AI worker told me off mic that AI is evolving fast.
He's got to learn to work with it or be replaced by it.
Marketplace's China correspondent Jennifer Pack there contributing to our tech program. You can stream that full report from our homepage now. Checking markets this morning, Dow and S&P futures are both down 0.2%. NASDAQ futures are down 0.3%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. On the road and at home, customers can simplify their insurance needs and protect what's important by bundling home and auto with Progressive Insurance. Learn more about Progressive and bundling at progressive.com. And by This Old House Radio Hour podcast, answering listeners' DIY and renovation questions and diving into home design trends, available in podcast apps.
Starting soon, when you search for a gadget or gizmo at BestBuy.com, some of the items will not be from Best Buy. Third-party sellers are being added, Amazon and Walmart style. Reporter Daniel Ackerman looks at pluses and minuses.
Amazon has a third-party marketplace. So does Walmart and Lowe's and Nordstrom, Kohl's, Macy's, and Target. So if anything, Best Buy is late to the party with this launch. But it's still an appealing move for a retailer who wants to seem like it offers anything you could ever want, says Anthony Chikumba, a consumer sector analyst at Loop Capital Markets.
So it gives Best Buy much more of an endless aisle as compared to all the products that they currently stock and sell themselves.
And the best part of that endless aisle is it doesn't require an endless warehouse.
Usually Best Buy will not stock the product because they just don't think it's going to sell frequently enough to justify having it in their assortment.
And since retailers like Best Buy already have websites to sell their own stuff, it doesn't take much investment to open the gates to other sellers. Michael Baker, a senior research analyst at D.A. Davidson, says it's kind of like free money.
Those third-party marketplaces have very strong margins because you're basically just taking a royalty.
But one risk of turning yourself into a marketplace, you could be giving your competitors a boost, says Neil Saunders, a retail analyst at Global Data.
If there is overlap with the core categories Best Buy sells, there can be cannibalization. People could buy a marketplace product rather than a Best Buy product, and that can be problematic.
But Saunders says the bigger risk is reputational. If a customer buys a TV from a third party and that TV arrives 2 weeks late or in two pieces,
guess who the customer blames? It's Best Buy because that's the name that's on the header of the website. And even though they might be dealing with a third party, the customer still sees this as a Best Buy problem.
There are ways retailers can manage this reputational risk, says Tony Moreno of Harvard Business School. For one, they can vet anyone who wants to sell through their site.
There are marketplaces that are more open, like Amazon, for example. Like many vendors can list on Amazon, but companies like Best Buy can be selective about which vendors they want to bring to the platform.
And once they have vendors on board, retailers can sell them other services like advertising and logistics.
Walmart is now doing a lot of advertising and a lot of fulfillment. So part of the money that they make on the marketplace is from selling services to vendors that use Walmart's infrastructure.
Moreno says, when you step back and blur your eyes a little, a lot of these retailers are starting to look like tech companies. I'm Daniel Ackerman for Marketplace.
And after a shipment of frozen shrimp bound for Walmart set off radiation detectors at U.S. ports, the FDA is telling people to watch out for the Great Value brand. Three lots of the frozen shrimp from one supplier in Indonesia have low levels of radioactive cesium-137, byproduct of nuclear reactors and medical equipment. The FDA says this does not pose an acute health hazard, but it is not good. The FDA alert says if you have one of the lots from Walmart, throw it away. Online, the search words FDA advises shrimp will get you the specific lot numbers. It's not clear how the shrimp got exposed to the radioactivity. I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Begley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. There's a local drive for the National Morrow Donor Program Friday, August 22nd from 11 to 2 and again from 5 to 7 at the Grand Rapids Dairy Queen. Healthy individuals ages 18 to 35 can get their cheeks swabbed at the event and register to possibly save a life. Sometimes the only hope for a cure comes from an unrelated donor. You can also join the registry by texting Cure Cancer Today without spaces to 61474. The Saxon Bog near Meadowlands invites you to a reception for their artists in residence.